Good morning. I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. 10 days from now, on July 1st, the state of Maryland will officially reopen, 15 months after businesses, schools, and government offices were locked down to stop the spread of the coronavirus, and we started donning masks to keep ourselves and others safe, all restrictions are being lifted. The life itself has felt nearly frozen in time. A lot has changed. With us to talk about some of the changes is quantitative futurist Amy Webb. Webb is founder of the Future Today Institute. FTI advises Fortune 500 and Global 1000 companies, government agencies, and nonprofits about how to prepare for the unexpected. Webb is also professor of strategic foresight at the NYU Stern School of Business. Welcome back to On the Record, Amy.
Hey, Sheila. It's always great to be here with you.
Yeah, and we have not spoken to you since last October. What have been some of your biggest takeaways, personally and otherwise, from life during the pandemic?
Well, how much time do we have? So it's been an interesting 6 or 7 months, to be sure. I think in terms of just how people interact with each other, clearly we're in a period of transition. I think people are still trying to sort out what their digital and real world lives look like. We've certainly seen increased instances of civic and social unrest, although we're also seeing instances of people working really hard to come together. And in terms of how organizations and companies are dealing with change, my number one observation is that, no company wants to be surprised again. And no organization wants to be surprised again. And so we are starting to see some efforts made to develop capacity for foresight, which is not making predictions, but rather making preparations for the future.
Well, on that point, preparations, how well prepared would you say we are for reopening?
I've spent the majority of my time in Maryland since the start of this. Our offices are in New York, and so I'm somebody who's here for part of the week and in New York City for part of the week. I don't know. I think the compliance rates in Maryland are certainly better than they are in other parts of the country, but we have some stark realities. Not everybody is vaccinated, and a lot of kids aren't yet able to get vaccines. So I think the preparedness of the state is important, but how willing people are to continue to abide by safety guidelines and restrictions is going to be critical going forward.
We talk with you periodically, and you often bring up concerns about consumer privacy. How has this year plus of pandemic changes in commerce, in education, in healthcare influenced your thoughts about privacy?
Well, it's unfortunately only confirmed my existing biases, which are that consumers are always willing to give up their privacy for convenience. We see this over and over again. And likewise, organizations are intent on using more and more data, but they're not necessarily secure. And so we saw the tension between these two things start to cause serious trouble over the past year. Lots of organizations are seeing new types of ransomware attacks. And, cybersecurity has certainly not been a primary focus for a lot of organizations. Likewise, people are sharing enormous amounts of data. If you stop and think about every single time you get on a web conference, whether you're using Teams or Zoom or Google Hangouts, or I guess it's called Meet now, Google Meet, there's a wealth of data in back of you and in front of you. That is also a security issue. It's if you're somebody who's really concerned about others seeing your social security number, or getting access to that, but you're not stopping to think about all of the personal details that are revealed behind you in the photo frames that you've artfully arranged on your countertop or your bookshelf, the books that you've put there on purpose, family members in the background. And not everybody is in a situation where they can make choices about what to or not to reveal. So I think we are entering a new phase of surveillance. I mean, we certainly have with regard to contact tracing and filling out forms for work and school to indicate that we haven't been exposed to the virus. But, you know, there's a lot of other ways in which we are opening ourselves up to surveillance. And, you know, the virus has been very good to tech companies who have seen their market share expand and their user bases expand dramatically. And obviously usage rates go way up.
Well, and obviously we have some choice in what photos we display behind us, artfully arranged, as you said. But I mean, for a lot of what you're talking about, to engage, we were just hanging on during the pandemic anyway. We would connect whatever the requirements were. What kind of choice did we have?
Well, again, I think this has to do with some basic digital literacy. You know, you could argue that we didn't have a lot of time to prepare, that this was a black swan event, sort of a rare once-in-a-lifetime occurrence. You know, in reality, it wasn't. And quite frankly, I don't even believe in black swan events. I believe people sometimes, you know, ignore the signals in front of them. This was more like a gray rhino event, which is a slow-moving, enormous, obvious set of signals that we just ignored for a long time. And those have to do with the discovery of novel viruses, our inability to make decisions quickly when it comes to science being politicized. You know, I could go on and on, not to mention the serious problems that we have in Maryland, but also in other places around the country when it comes to digital connectivity. There is a serious and unforgivable digital divide that is of our own making.
That's Amy Webb, founder of the Future Today Institute. On the record on WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the influence the COVID-19 pandemic has had on the economy and life in general. Webb is also the author of The Signals Are Talking, Why Today's Fringe is Tomorrow's Mainstream, and The Big Nine, How the Tech Titans and Their Thinking Machines Could Warp Humanity. So talking about changes on the economy, what about travel? I mean, have you flown or taken a train recently?
You know what? I was thinking about that the other day. I'm somebody who, you know, for work, I was either on a plane or a train 80% of my time, lots of the time, right? I have not flown. I think it was Davos. I think it was the last World Economic Forum that was held in person was the last time I was on a plane. And I think the question you're probably getting at has to do with business travel. And that's really significant to a state like Maryland, where, you know, ostensibly you want that business travel to be happening because it supports the local economy. I don't know that that's going to come back. I can tell you that today I have met with my clients in Oslo, Norway, in Stockholm, Sweden, in Redmond, Washington. Who else did I talk to today? I guess I'm talking to you. You're in Baltimore. And I had a team meeting where, and you know, some of my team are in New York City and others are spread around the country. There's no way that I would have been able to do that much work in that many places if we weren't in an environment that now requires video conferencing. Now there's certainly benefits to being on the ground and being able to walk the halls and talk to our clients and, you know, just be around people. But there's something to be said for the amount of work that we can do remotely and still deliver incredible value back. So I'm not 100% sure that business travel is going to come back the way that it was. It's really, really expensive.
What has really surprised you over the last year and a half?
You know, this is going to sound naive, but whatever. We're all friends, right?
I hope.
I'm really surprised that there was so much vaccine hesitancy, especially in Maryland, where we have such a, you know, we've got world-class hospital systems here. We have a highly educated populace. You know, I'm just really surprised. And the thing that I hear the most is people are concerned about how fast the vaccines were developed. And this comment means that we're not doing a good enough job of explaining how certain things work. I mean, the reason that the vaccines were developed fast actually had nothing to do with funding, or it's something probably to do with funding. It didn't have to do with politics. It had to do with earlier work in an area called synthetic biology. Moderna and BioNTech are companies that have been around for 10 years. And it, you know, the bottom line is they were already doing research that made sense in other areas. I mean, thank God the virus didn't happen 10 years ago. We didn't have the technology at that point to do the sequencing and to do the calculations and to do the synthesis, like all the stuff that's required to figure out what an organism is and what to do with it. You know, we're living in the year 2021 now, where we've got incredible technology at our fingertips. So, you know, the only thing that really slowed down the vaccine process was production. But I think the challenge is that people don't really understand what, and that makes sense. Like, not everybody should know exactly what messenger RNA is or does, but I guess I was surprised that there was such a, you know, people weren't willing to stop and think rationally. Instead, fear took over. You know, I have some very educated friends who refuse to take the vaccine because they, you know, they believe in sort of conspiracy theories about potential effects, or they're concerned about the speed. And no matter how many times I explain to them, like, hey, this is the actual science, and like, yeah, this is actually not weird at all. There's nothing strange about how quickly we got to a solution. It doesn't seem to matter that fear has taken over.
Are there positive aspects to all the disruption from the pandemic?
Yeah, of course.
Like
pre-pandemic, there was very little telehealth, and you know, that's ridiculous. We should absolutely be able to visit healthcare providers in a more extensible way. You know, like it's fine. You don't have to go to a doctor's office for every single thing. So some of that flexibility is great. You know, there's a lot of companies that should have gone through a digital transformation process a long time ago, and they didn't, because it's expensive and it's challenging. And for all the reasons that everybody knows, well, you know, they kind of had to do that quickly and play catch up, and they're going to be better off for it in the long run. You know, we've had to have some conversations about trust, and we've had to acknowledge that for some reason in this country, you know, scientists are trusted. They're among the most trusted people. And yet we don't trust science. You know, the insight there is that we need to do a better job of educating. And then let's talk about education. It's crazy and unforgivable that we are in such dire, that we have so deprioritized education in this country. And quite frankly, in a lot of places around the state of Maryland, that kids couldn't have a normal, any sense of a normal education over these past 18 months. You know, and why? Because we're not giving schools, the public schools, the resources they need. And, you know, fine. So the schools, some of the schools had resources, but families didn't. The internet connectivity situation is absolutely abominable. And the fact that people don't have enough access to participate in the, you know, daily requirements of everyday life is ridiculous. We're not an emerging economy. We're the world's largest economy, and we can't get our acts together with connectivity. So I think shining the light on some of these things and putting them into better focus is going to be good going forward. And then there was all the, you know, we saw a lot of ingenuity from everyday people trying to manage. So I would say it was an awful situation, but as we are starting to open up, there are benefits here that we should continue to pay forward.
We need to take a quick break here on the record. We're talking about the pandemic's impact on commerce, travel, and privacy with Amy Webb, who founded the Future Today Institute. Quick break, and then we'll get highlights from FTI's annual Tech Trends to watch for. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to wypr.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today with Amy Webb, quantitative futurist and founder of the Future Today Institute. She shared some ideas about how commerce and privacy changed during the pandemic. Now I want to talk about tech trends. You release a tech trends report annually, and the past few years, including this one, you keep telling us smartphones are on the way out. Amy, everyone around me is still running their lives from a smartphone. In my world, they are still ubiquitous. Please help me understand why you keep claiming they're going to disappear.
Well, I have a smartphone too. So the takeaway here is that they're not going away tomorrow, but that we're at the beginning of a transition. And that was true starting in 2018. I know everybody has a smartphone. We're all glued to our smartphones. But the penetration rate of the number of new sales is just not what it used to be. So the rate of people buying new phones doesn't look like it used to. They're holding onto those phones longer. And there's a lot of reasons why. Phones are way more expensive than they used to be. The latest Samsung phone is, you know, $1,000. Apple phones go for $1,000. I mean, you could buy a computer for less money than that, right? So part of what's happening is the investment structure. People can't afford those devices, and the operators have built subscription models, as a way to help people afford them. But all of this is about extracting more revenue out of the individual consumer. And at some point, there are going to be peripherals. In fact, we're already seeing them that are attractive and that perform a lot of that same functionality, like watches and wristbands. And in the next 18 to 24 months, smart glasses that don't look like crazy VR headsets, but rather look like, you know, they look like everyday glasses. They are coming. And, you know, that's going to start to shift how we, the interfaces that we use in our everyday lives. And the focus will be much less on a tiny screen that we hold in our hands, over time, not overnight, but over the next several years, and instead to a constellation of devices that we will wear. And at some point, we will start embedding or ingesting even.
Ingesting.
Yeah. So, there are tiny computers that are starting to be used that you can swallow. It's the size of a pill to monitor different levels for things. But, you know, we're moving into an era where hardware and wetware are merging. And so some of the most promising areas of biotechnologies bring together the traditional world of biology with a more, you know, advanced world of mechanics in new and unusual ways, whether that's a personal wireless body, you know, network. Some people in Silicon Valley who are into the quantified self movement, you know, people who are sort of CEOs of companies are wearing continuous glucose monitors who aren't even diabetic. But they're doing this in order to optimize their daily lives. There are toilets coming to market that will take a urinalysis and have other sensor data every time you go. There are beds that cool automatically, that monitor your temperature and your respiration and your heart rate, and then try to optimize you while you're sleeping. So there's a lot that's already here, and there's a lot more that's coming.
That's Amy Webb, founder of the Future Today Institute. Here on the Record on WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. Forbes magazine calls Webb one of the five women changing the world, and the BBC named her one of the most inspiring and influential top 100 women in 2019. We're talking about tech trends to watch out for in 2021 and beyond. You foresee an upswing in the use of home surveillance systems and smart appliances. Talk about that.
I do. And in fact, last week, we started to see some of that in action. So a lot of people who are spending more time at home because of the virus, we've seen a lot of technology adoption. And some of that includes a smart interface like an Alexa device, but also smart cameras on doors. So there's a lot of home-based surveillance technologies that people are using. And what's interesting about that is that, especially in a city like Baltimore, Baltimore is, at least in my observation, is fairly fragmented in terms of city management. And I know that there have been attempts to bring fiber into the city. This is not a city where things happen quickly in terms of governance, or where there's a lot of long-term planning in terms of governance. So this creates a vulnerability. And you might have heard that last week Amazon launched something called its Sidewalk program, which is where, you know, devices that are connected to each other in what's called a mesh network, at the scale of a neighborhood. You know, if somebody's network drops or if it's a little janky, if there's a problem, the other devices can pick up unused bandwidth so that everybody is always connected. There's some other interesting components. So if you use a tag, it's a little tiny receiver that you could put on your keychain, for example, or your bike or your kid, you would always be able to find whatever that is as long as it's within the mesh network. Now, here's what's interesting. Baltimore doesn't really have smart city infrastructure, at least not the way that I would categorize it. And a lot of cities in the country have had a hard time passing smart city legislation, in part because of surveillance and cost and, you know, just general disagreement and politicking. Amazon has managed to create smart city infrastructure without having to go through a city council or a mayor's office or anything else, simply by inviting consumers to buy their stuff. And so if you've got a Ring camera and an Alexa device and your neighbors do too, you have built a tiny smart city system that you've opted into, that you've paid for, that is providing value to you, but is also providing value back to Amazon, which is then providing value to law enforcement or to other entities that would use those data. You know, it was a really, really smart loophole that Amazon exploited. And, I think something that a lot of cities are going to look back at probably 5 or 10 years from now and say, well, you know what? We missed that one. How do we not see that?
Well, but doesn't it raise privacy questions?
I mean, from a personal level, you know, sure. It absolutely raises privacy questions, but from a legal standpoint, this is a consumer-based opt-in system. So nobody at the moment is violating any city issues. Now, again, the reason that this is, I think, important and interesting is because just after the virus hit, a lot of cities, one was Westport, Connecticut, but a lot of cities in the country were trying to put up smart cameras with infrared and different sensing technologies in key areas of crowding to like make sure that if anybody had symptoms that were visual, so an elevated respiration rate or body temperature or whatever, that it would be, you know, easy to pick them out and, I guess, I don't know, ask them to leave. I don't know what the plan was for after you found that person. I don't know of any communities that were okay with that type of camera surveillance, right? They were all like, no, we don't want that. We don't want to be surveilled. And yet it's not like your neighbors are asking you, hey, is it cool if we install a Ring camera? You know, if you live across the street from somebody with a smart camera doorbell, you know, you can see what's going on in that other yard. It's not like anybody asked permission. So I think when it is a city asking for permission, everybody feels like it's very Orwellian. But when it's your neighbor, like nobody thinks to ask twice. And you probably didn't stop to, if you installed something like that, you probably didn't think, huh, should I walk around and make sure everybody's cool with this, right? It's your private property. So no, you don't have to ask. So that's the key difference here.
You're giving me a lot to think about. And I have questions for the next time we talk, but we're out of time. Amy, it's always so interesting to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks, Sheila.
Amy Webb is a quantitative futurist and founder of the Future Today Institute. We've been talking about the Institute's annual Tech Trends Report. We have a link to more information about it at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. On the Record's director and engineer is Nathan Sterner. Maureen Harvey and Melissa Gear produced the program. John Ahrens wrote and recorded the On the Record theme music. Tamala Krimple is digital content director. I'm your host, Sheila Cast. Very glad you're with us on the Record. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.